Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Halloween, everybody.
Happy Halloween. Welcome to... This is our first show that we've actually done on Halloween. I think so. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, on the actual night, I think, probably. Yeah. Fascinating.
It is fascinating. Happy Halloween, everyone. I hope you're living it up.
So there's a reason why tonight's show will be scary. I mean, we actually have an excuse.
Yeah, we do have an excuse. It's damn right.
So what are you going as this year, Jerry?
I'm going as myself, which scares enough people.
We should have dressed up for the show.
Absolutely audio,
no one could see us. Yes.
Audio show. Yeah, we should have dressed up. Yeah, I'm like a cross between Richard Nixon and this year. No. We both have seen the latest and hopefully last movie in the Saw series.
Yeah, we have. You know, We just got off that the week long series celebrating horror movies, five nights in a row, and Thursday night was the Saw show, which everyone can find in the archives with James Wan and Lee Whannell and the creators of the franchise. So what strikes me about it is that, man, it started as a completely different monster from that first movie that is essentially a thriller.
Yeah.
To what it became. And so I've seen the first three. I didn't see 4, 5, 6.
You lucky son of a bitch.
And then I saw the 3D that opened just this weekend on my birthday Friday night. What a gift that was!
My God, I mean,
it was more fun. I mean, we were joking throughout, like the stunt with the guy that was super glued to the chair.
Oh yeah! Oh God!
And he's trying his best to get off of the back of the chair and save them, and his skin is tearing apart and all that kind of stuff. And then he fails and. I was like, well, at least he tried. No skin off his back. So we were like, the whole movie, we were playing this game.
It was a desperate ploy on their part, I guess, because last year they got their ass handed to them by the Paranormal Activity people. And maybe this year, too, when the final grosses are done at the end of the year. But did you think this needed to be in 3D?
No, I mean, it's a gimmick. And
yeah.
But you know, it grossed $10 million more than the last one, which the last one was the bomb of the series.
Yeah.
But it's still, but that's, you know, a large percentage of that, I'm sure, is the extra ticket price for 3D.
Oh, definitely.
And I took my glasses off a couple of times. I mean, it was decent 3D. It was fine. But I took my glasses off a couple of times, and the foreground pops at you, and the background is... to the naked eye, all blurred. So when you put on your glasses again, there's something about it. It makes the background look fake.
Yeah,
the background looked really fake. It looked like a CGI wall or something that everyone was standing in front of.
That's true.
For some reason, it looked like the movie actually looks like a cheap British 80s horror movie. Hellraiser is a good movie, but it looked like that to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had that going for it. What I couldn't get over with this, and also with the Wes Craven film, I Sold a Keep or Take or whatever it was called.
My Soul to Take.
Yeah, thank you. It made such a vivid impression on me.
My two hours to take.
Yeah, I just, you know, yeah, the 3D looks good, but I'm watching, even for the Saw movie, there was no reason to shoot this in 3D, though. Except that opening sequence, yes, where there was stuff flying out and everything, and the scene that you were talking about. But for the most part, it was like, okay, there really wasn't a reason to the 3D doesn't really come at you, in that sense.
If it did, we'd be complaining that it was the gimmick. Popping out at you.
Look,
yeah.
Seven films in. I don't expect anything. But I thought they'd do something special, and it's every film is the same in that sense. It's the unsolved mysteries ending. I keep expecting Robert Stack to come back from the dead, really, and just like, yes, this, and this is going on.
You know, it is what it is. But
yeah,
what not my cup of tea. But what surprised me is how shoddily it was made.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't made well.
I agree with you 100%. It could be a very compelling story. Had they really put some more time into the actual story and everything.
Yeah, and even beyond the story, I'm talking about the technical aspect of it. I mean, the film looks shoddy.
Oh, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But
that's my take.
Speaking of not so shoddy, I did see a very good horror film this weekend.
Okay.
Monsters, which was on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I loved it. I know, some people really liked it. Some people have been very mixed mixed to negative about it. But I was really enthralled with this story of these, there's the aliens that are in an infected zone in Mexico. The space probe has crashed, and these two people trying to get through to the United States from Central America through Mexico, the infected zone, and these aliens. And it was just fascinating, like Cloverfield meets District 9 is what it's been described as. And
right.
That's a fair description. But I really loved it. We watched it last night, and I was just like, wow, this is really cool. I mean, I was really glued to the TV and everything, and one of the reasons I love On Demand is that you can show, they show these films that don't get a wide release, and I wish it would.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would do very well.
Yeah, I need to check that out, because I've read a lot about it. I've checked out a couple of movies recently that if we have time we'll talk about later on tonight.
Okay.
or Wednesday night if we don't have time. We got a pretty packed show, but the two movies are Love and Other Drugs and Unstoppable.
Cool. Awesome.
So, and they're both really, really good. So let's start tonight. A little bit later on in the evening we'll be bringing on from Glass Eye Picks Larry Fessenden, Glenn McQuaid, and Joe Maggio to talk about an exciting new project. They're doing essentially radio plays in the horror genre.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it's both an old-fashioned and an extremely high-tech kind of concept that they've come up with. And we thought it was perfect for a Halloween theme show. So we're going to bring them on a little bit later. But first, premiering tonight. Jerry, you looking forward to this?
Yes, I am.
Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern on AMC TV, director Frank Darabont, he helms the first premiere episode. It's based on a really popular graphic novel called The Walking Dead, obviously, and it is terrific. It's a terrific series, and it's very brave television, and genre fans are going to eat this up. And it's executive produced by Gail Ann Hurd. Now, Gail Ann Hurd is a tremendous producer. She's produced Aliens, The Terminator, several De Palma films that obviously we hold a close place in our hearts for her just based on that. It's her cup of tea, Walking Dead. And so we had a chance to sit down and talk to her about the series, and here's what she had to say.
You even know what's going on? I woke up in the hospital. That's all I know.
Lori, call!
But you know about the dead people, right?
I saw a lot of that out on the loading dock, even tossed down the stairwell.
Not the ones they put down, the walkers. Saying on the news some kind of virus. Things got crazy. Man, you won't believe the panic. The broadcast stopped. And that was the last we heard.
My wife and son, they're alive.
I think they got out of here.
They're in Atlanta.
Why there?
Military protection, shelter, food. They told people to go there. Said they were working out how to solve this thing. van sounds like a good deal.
Listen, one thing. They may not seem like much one at a time, but in a group all hungry, man, you watch your ass.
I love The Walking Dead. I thought it was exhilarating. And I know that you're a fan of genre and a fan of the zombie kind of subgenre, too. And I'm wondering, what are the elements of this particular material that drew you and kind of were elevated in that subgenre?
Well, certainly with underlying material like Robert Kirkman's series of graphic novels, you have the perfect ingredients. You have a powerful cast of characters from the comic book,
mm-hmm.
Who are complex and at times morally ambiguous, and you have a journey that they take, which is perfect for a television series, and even before the series won the Eisner this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was clear that it was one of the top continuing series in the comic book genre.
Well, there's also, with the horror genre, it has a unique element to it in that it can speak to where we are in the world and kind of social commentary in a way it offers as a genre a lot of times in the best work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has, I think, from the very beginning.
Yeah. What about
commenting
The Walking Dead?
On communism and sort of fear, or I think in this case, the unsettled feeling like an apocalypse is right around the corner. You know, whether
mm-hmm.
it's the global financial apocalypse or the apocalypses we've seen on television from natural disasters.
Yeah.
Somehow, all of us are living with that kind of fear, and this is a way to, you know. This is a way to experience that kind of earth-shattering, you know, demise of society through
right.
the characters who survive.
And there's something that a quote from Mr. Kirkman that I read in the materials that I'm paraphrasing. when you're this close to death, you finally start
living. Yes.
You start appreciating life. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, when every breath may be your last,
mm-hmm.
that's when you realize how much you love, in the case of Rick Grimes, how much you love your family, how you want to make your relationships work, how much you love your family.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it also drives people to do things they wouldn't normally do, because we don't have the rules of society any longer. I mean, even though Rick is from law enforcement, if you've seen the press kit, you know, as he says, all I am anymore is a man looking for his wife and son. So those rules don't apply, and there's no one to enforce them.
Well, as you said, you have a great comic book series, graphic novel to work from Robert Kirkman. Was this the Bible kind of for the production? Is that a template that you use for story and visuals? And
yes, I mean, I think, you know, if you've seen the material, some of the iconic panels
mm-hmm.
We've brought to life. And at the same time, I think it's important to look at it as wonderful source material, but allowing us to branch off and delve into, you know, characters even more deeply and situations, even more powerfully, and to be able to venture off that path.
Yeah.
At times with new characters, but then always coming back to the touchstone of Kirkman's, you know, great graphic novels.
Yeah, well, he was close to the production, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, he is indeed, you know, an executive producer along with Frank and me, and he was on set. He wrote the fourth episode. He was involved in all of the casting decisions. He's been involved in post production, and as Frank is the first to say, you know, we all want to make sure that he's happy because he is the creator of this universe.
And Mr. Darabont, obviously he's one of our great filmmakers. And I remember seeing him when he was doing The Mist. You know, he was renowned for Shawshank and Green
yes.
Mile. And,
yes, his Stephen King.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And The Mist seemed to be a different animal entirely, and he seemed so giddy to be making kind of his monster movie. So I could tell why his vision and his sensibilities were perfect for this material. How do you think they fit in with
well,
the
Well, absolutely, you know, Frank is a genre geek like the rest of us,
mm-hmm.
And he loves genre films. He's an aficionado from way back, and you know, and the zombie subgenre is one that you know that I think he likes and wanted to explore more than any other, and
mm-hmm.
With The Walking Dead, we have the perfect template.
And I was pleasantly surprised that the material did not have to be softened at all.
No.
For television, were there conversations that took place before you went into production to make sure that you were all on the same page in terms of that?
Absolutely. We had a creative meeting. All of the terrific AMC executives flew down to Atlanta before we started shooting, and we talked about what we could and couldn't do, and they showed us films that they broadcast during Fear Fest.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them screened completely uncut, unedited for television, and we realized there was nothing that we intended to put on screen that would be in any way softened by their standards and practices, and we were happily surprised.
Yeah.
And in fact, we've already submitted 5 of the 6 episodes, and we have not received one note from standards and practices saying, you know, this is too extreme for broadcast.
Wow, it is brave television. It's a new frontier in television, isn't it?
It is, but you know, but I think that AMC is known for that.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of working in television, I mean, you've had such a highly successful career producing features. I'm wondering if working in television is a different beast altogether, or at the end of the day, are you still dealing with the same set of challenges?
Well, the wonderful thing about television is that once the network says go, you are in the thick of it, and it's relentless in terms of the pace. The fact that you roll week to week into you know new episodes, and there is no opportunity at all to go over because of the knock-on effect. You know, every episode had to be finished on schedule, regardless of you know what we're up against. So that's both frightening and exhilarating at the same time. And we you know, even though the budgets were certainly smaller than we've dealt with in features, we always felt as if we were able to get everything that we wanted on screen.
Yeah.
And that there were no compromises.
It's almost like the time that you're allotted to create an entire season is the time that you'd be allotted to film one feature.
Exactly. And a feature is, you know, the maximum 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have, you know, probably 6 hours of television. And it's the same amount of time.
What does that pace do for the creative process? Do you feel it's beneficial in any way?
You know, it is, you know, you It can be, as I said, I mean, before, it can be incredibly intimidating,
mm-hmm.
Because there is no margin for error. But at the same time, you know, necessity is often the mother of invention.
Right.
And when you don't have the latitude to go over or turn in a draft late or, you know, get an extra day of prep or an extra day of shooting, you make it work. And it means that you have to have the best team put together. And we do with the cast in front of the camera and the crew behind the camera. They were up for the challenge.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the element of the notion of creating kind of a family with your team. And I know that films are strange because you spend 3 months in the thick of it with this team of creative people, and you get close, and then it's goodbye, and you don't see many of them for a while.
Yeah,
but
another great thing about television is the family is in it for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt it was very important to make sure that everyone was pulling in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that truly everyone is looking forward to, you know, fingers crossed, coming back for a second season.
I think you're in there. I cannot imagine that this thing will not be a huge success.
Well,
that's,
you know,
that's my
as an expression I picked up in the South, God willing and the creek don't rise.
That's right. That's right.
It's something that we would be thrilled and honored to be able to tackle with a 13-episode season, so we can really get into the characters and introduced a few more next season.
I'm curious, because you've been in the business for, you know, going on 30 years producing features, and how has that? One of the most profound ways that the business of making movies has changed, and how has it changed what you do?
Well, it's, over the course of my career, the number of studios has diminished. The
mm-hmm.
number of films that the studios that are, you know, the number of films made by each studio is also more limited. You know, and I think that studios are unwilling to take many chances anymore. I wonder if you know, the Terminator would be made now, because it didn't come from pre-existing material. It was an original screenplay by, at that time, an unknown writer director.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it that's what concerns me, is that there are fewer opportunities now in the feature film world. On the other hand, there are more opportunities on television.
Yeah.
There were far fewer networks in the past, and now there are not only more networks, but more risks being taken in television than in features.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the television medium, they're the medium that are taking the risks now. And they're getting all the great talent as a result.
Exactly. I mean, you know, who would have predicted, you know, 10 years ago that, you know, Martin Scorsese would have a series on television, you know, or that the writer-director of the Shawshank Redemption would be chomping at the bit to jump into another 13 episodes.
Absolutely.
You know, and you know, you have series, you know, period pieces like Boardwalk Empire and like Mad Men, and then you have the world of speculative fiction like Lost,
mm-hmm.
you know, and now you have comic book based series. It really is. It really feels as if the sky's the limit.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you will be, because I know that you've lived with it and seen it many times, but. Will you be watching the premiere on Halloween night, just like the rest of America?
Are you kidding? Of course I will. I cannot wait. Honestly cannot wait. You know, I'm looking forward to the screening when we're able to see it in a movie theater, which is fun and exciting. But I'm also excited to see it in the medium in which we made it, which is for people to watch at home, hopefully with their friends and family.
You know, and the horror genre really has a very loyal and protective fan base. And I'm curious to know what kind of interactions you've had with that fan base concerning this project.
Well, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to launch the first footage at Comic-Con in San Diego is it really is the perfect marriage between a comic book and another medium, television in this case. And it was important for us to reach out to the fans and say, listen, you know, we know this is important to you. You know, you've been there since the beginning, since 2003 with the, when the series launched. You've been loyal and faithful to this, and we take it seriously, too. We want to do the best possible job in adapting it, you know, and let us know what you think. And as you know, genre fans are not shy. They will let you know what they think.
Yeah.
No holds barred. And it's also why we you know, the second round of footage that went public, we screened yesterday at New York Comic Con.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about one particular future project that's been talked about. We are huge De Palma aficionados on the show. We've done like five or six shows on his films. And so I know he's gone off to do Toyer, but what's the status with the Boston Stranglers project?
Well, the company that was going to make it was purchased by another company, Overture. And so now we have to sort all of the rights issues out before we can move forward.
Yeah, it's a real taxing long process to get some of these projects off the ground, isn't it?
It is, but you never say die.
Yeah, exactly.
Except when you're a zombie.
Hello, can anybody hear my voice?
Hey, hello. We're just outside the city. Hello? Damn it.
We ought to warn people away from the city.
Folks got no idea what they're getting into.
Okay, that is producer Gail Ann Hurd. The producer of hits like The Terminator and Aliens, and her new project is The Walking Dead, premieres tonight AMC TV at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's a great, great show. I think people are going to love it.
Oh, it looks fascinating. I can't wait to check it out. So, I mean, at least we got 6 weeks of great television, it looks like. So.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said in the previous episodes this month, the first two episodes are fantastic. I can't wait to see where they go with it. I mean, as I'm not a reader of that particular comic book, but so I don't know the progression of the story. So it's very surprising and very, very brave television. So do you think the Terminator would not be made today?
Oh, I think the Terminator would be made today. But I mean, that's a loaded thought right there, because, you know, Arnold's the governator right now, and, you know, there's a big article in The Wrap last week that they don't know really what he's going to do with himself, you know, once he leaves.
No. I mean, if the Terminator was never made, and the situations that she said it, an unknown director, an original screenplay came to the studio, do you think it would have a chance of being made today?
Yeah, but it would be a limited release, kind of like more. It might be, as someone said, a sci-fi original movie, but oh God, I hope not. But that's a very good point. I mean, look, I've said it many times on this show and before. If Lawrence of Arabia was made today, it would be an art house film.
Yeah,
it would not be, you know, it would not play everywhere, and it wouldn't play. It would be an art house film at best, if not, and maybe just masterpiece theater. If you want to be the God's honest truth.
People will be watching it on their cell phones.
Yeah, and would defeat the whole
Which
purpose.
Is the perfect way to watch Lords of Arabia.
Oh, yeah, yeah, really. I mean, yeah, God, yeah, the desert. Yeah, the desert looks great on a one-inch screen there, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like a beach when it's
exactly.
on your cell phone.
Exactly.
All right, we got a great remainder of the show for you. A little bit later, we're going to be tackling the latest home entertainment releases. With Aaron Adidias, our home entertainment correspondent, we'll be announcing the winners of our giveaways for the DVDs of The Human Centipede and the 25th anniversary box set of The Goonies. And we will be premiering the film scores for Fair Game, the new Doug Liman film, Welcome to the Rileys, the new Jay Kasdan film, and the new Harry Potter. The biggest of them all. So stay tuned for that. Alexander Splatt composed the Harry Potter. So.
Oh, really? Cool.
He just won some international composer award. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact information, but I mean, he is he's the tops now. I mean, he's one of the great composers now we have in film.
I agree with that completely.
All right, but first up, before we get into all of that, let's continue our kind of Halloween theme here and bring on our next guests. Glass Eye Picks is the studio behind modern horror treats like I Sell the Dead, House of the Devil, and Stakeland, and their latest project could be their boldest yet, a return to the radio stylings of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater. Tales from Beyond the Pale is a terrific new series of audio plays that you can download right from your computer, and you can find each episode at talesfrombeyondthepale.com, where the first installment is now available for download. Now, that first episode is titled Man on the Ledge, and it stars Vincent D'Onofrio and is written and directed by Joe Maggio, who appeared on the show several months ago to discuss his last film, The Terrific Bitter Feast. And right now, we're pleased to welcome Joe back to the show, as well as Glass Eye Picks curators and producers Larry Fessenden and Glenn McQuaid. Let me bring on their lines here. Gentlemen, you're on. How are you?
Hey, this is Larry.
Hey, guys,
are you
how's it going?
Hey. We hear you loud and clear.
Am I on?
Everyone is on. Everyone is on.
Happy Halloween, guys.
Hey, happy Halloween to you.
So, first of all, yeah, you bring up Halloween, obviously. It's Halloween tonight. Do you guys have any special rituals that you go through on Halloween night?
Well, I have a 10-year-old kid, so I'm standing in the middle of Tompkins Square Park dressed as the Invisible Man, and I'm running around attacking the children. Joe has a younger child. What are you up to, Joe?
I'm wearing ladybug antennae, and we just got in from our trick-or-treating in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. So,
okay. You're done? Are you done for the night?
Now my wife and I are starting. We're having our cocktail hour, so we're not done for the night, but we're done trick-or-treating tonight.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here carving up a few pumpkins, actually.
Oh, good. Everyone is in the Halloween spirit. It's great.
Yeah.
I'm trying to carve a pumpkin with the Tales from Beyond the Pale logo. It's dangerous, but if it works, it'll be worthwhile.
Glenn, send that around for the website, please.
Oh, I will. Either a photograph of that or my bloodied hands.
Well, let me tell you, this project excites me because it's kind of, it is old-fashioned and high-tech at the same time. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful idea, and I'm wondering, Larry, I'll start with you. What was the genesis of this?
It's been fun to pull out the old radio plays and when we're driving and play them for him. And in fact, Glenn and I were both heading up to the Stakeland set in our car in upstate New York, and we both looked at each other while we were listening to some Boris Karloff episode, and we said, God, man, we love this stuff. We should do it. Why not? And so, unfortunately, at Glass Eye, we have the vaguest idea, and we try to follow through and put it together. So Glenn and I have been building it for about 6 months, I guess, and we're very excited. We set an unrealistic deadline for Halloween, but we just snuck through. We're very happy about that.
You made it. Glenn, what? Tell me about the format of an audio play, essentially. What's special about that format? How does it capture the imagination unlike any other format?
Well, I think obviously we're asking everybody to just, close their eyes a little bit, or not close their eyes in the case of driving a car or anything like that, but to actually let their imagination wander. And it's been an interesting experience for me because I've written my own piece, and you really are just trying to find subtle ways of using sound and really, getting back to the idea of showing less you know, is more, and in this case, it's everything. We can't show anything, so it's a much more suggestive and evocative way of telling stories. So, in that respect, as a writer and a filmmaker, it's been a really interesting challenge to, you know, let go of all of our visual techniques.
And Joe's episode is a great example where there's a series of reveals. You sort of start thinking one thing, and then you slowly learn what's really going on. And you couldn't do it in film, the nature of his story. So
right.
Yeah. Joe, tell me about that. Tell me your approach by this concept. Tell me what ideas started to percolate for you and what excited you about this format.
Well, I mean, both Glenn and Larry, I think, have heard me say this before, I think I'm a good director, but I think I'm really more of a writer. So for me, I just love the idea that it was going to be entirely all about the language, really, and, you know, of course, the sound effects. But what I latched onto was this idea of creating a scene that I didn't have to cut off, you know, at five pages, you know, because it's a movie,
right.
And anything that goes on, you know, much longer than that, in the audience, just for whatever reason, the common wisdom is that they start to lose interest. And I thought that, you know, I could have a single scene that went on for 30 minutes, and I could really do everything I've always wanted to do, where, you know, lead the audience astray, let them think something, you know, it's going in one direction, and then reveal something, and it you know, it changes everything, and you take them down another road, and then you turn the tables again. So for me, it was really just, you know, an opportunity to do something I've always wanted to do, which is, you know, really focus on the language and not hold myself back at all as far as indulging in, you know, the complexity of a scene, for example.
Yeah.
And that's really all this is. It's a single scene that takes place, you know, on a window ledge in New York City, and it just goes on. And so it was a real blast for me to have that kind of freedom and that much time to work with it. So.
And your episode is available now at the talesfrombeyondthepale.com. You can, all of our listeners can go download it right now. And your episode actually features Vincent D'Onofrio. Tell me about the casting process with this, because obviously you want good performers, as Mr. D'Onofrio certainly is, but you're casting for voice as well, I would think.
Yeah. Well, you know, without giving too much away, you know, we wanted someone who, you know, certainly had, you know, big acting chops, but who could believably go in a kind of sinister direction. And Vincent D'Onofrio has just done, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen The Salt and Sea, or anything. He's just done so many wacky, crazy characters that a lot of people aren't aware of. And I just, you know, when his name popped up, and Larry or Glenn, one of them, you know, Larry, you had worked with him briefly on something last year. And it just seemed to make sense to me. It was like just a great, if he was willing to do it, I just thought it was a great casting idea. It's someone with, you know, incredible range as an actor, but who also has shown that they're not afraid to really, you know, sometimes an actor doesn't want to look really nuts, live wherever it needs, you know, the role needs to go. So
he's
fearless. He was so humble, and we had such a good time. You know, you're always nervous when you get someone of some stature to come in, but he was just one of the gang. And it just made it such a pleasure. In fact, he said he'd love to do it again. So
he's a natural for it, though, because of his voice and his vocals and everything. I mean, everything he's in, you know, we forget it's sound. And that's what's so great about these radio plays is sound is so important in motion pictures. We forget that sometimes, but it's the key, whether it's music or effects or the voice. We forget that. And we grew up on we had radio plays, you know, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the original Star Wars trilogy on NPR were made into radio plays, and they're fascinating. They took on a whole new dimension, and you know, my parents they grew up in the golden age of radio. So I mean, this is great that you're bringing this back.
When I was little, I mean, I'm so old now that they didn't even have video in my day. So you saw the movie. I was lucky to grow up in New York, so I went to the rep houses sometimes. But the only real way to see old movies was on TV. And what I would do is I'd record them on cassette, and I would listen to them. So I have this sense. That's how I would enjoy the pleasures of, you know, listening to old Cagney movies, old horror films, and even eventually movies like Taxi Driver and Jaws. I would sneak into the theater. So it was, you know, I've always come to movies with sound as a prominent element, and then with movies by, like, Ty West, sound again in a glass eye. And it was fun to invite the filmmakers to just turn off their cameras, as it were. It was also considerably cheap.
About that. Just tell me the filmmakers that you approached and what kind of ideas they've come up with.
Well, one of the things that's been so fun working with Glenn on this is he's traveled all over with his with I Sell the Dead. So he had met, for example, Paul Sollett, Ashley Thorpe, and some of our other folks. And then, of course, we've got our usual artists like Graham Resnick, Glenn himself, and Joe Maggio, who's just done Bitter Feast with us. So it's been really fun to reach out to all these different filmmakers and invite them, you know, to try their hand at this. And everybody jumped at the chance. It's been really fun. I think people are excited to be in production. J.T. Petty, his wife Sarah Langan, has done one, and she's, of course, a writer of scary novels, so it's been grand to reach out to people who are, in fact, jumping their usual format.
Yeah. Glenn, tell me about your episode.
My episode is called Trawler, and it's set on an old fishing trawler, and it's basically a couple of fishermen out trying to catch anything in a sort of a dilapidated stretch of ocean. And basically they pull up something that would have rather have been left alone. And so it's I suppose mine is the creature feature entry into the Tales from Beyond the Pale season one.
We have an amazing array of genres. We have sci-fi, we have Glenn's creature feature, we have sort of strange serial killer relationship stories, we have killer babies. Joe's is technically not supernatural. It's a wonderful array. We have a crazy one coming up next Tuesday by Simon Rumley, the loony British director of The Living and the Dead and Red, White, and Blue. So we're very excited to unleash that on the unsuspecting viewers.
I think that was one of our goals that we set, was to really find a good mix of sensibilities. So on top of each tale's content and genre being as different as you could imagine, so are the ways in which the tales are being told. I mean, it's great. It's pretty amazing to be able to mix someone like Joe Maggio next to Simon Rumley, next to, you know, we've a piece from Jeff Bueller, a science fiction piece with Ron Perlman and Doug Jones. So it's a crazy mix. It's going to be an insane soup of talent once they're all out there. I think it's going to take on a whole different tone once they're all kind of up there and next to one another.
So tell me how this.
We're,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go on,
man. No, you.
I was just curious to fill our listeners in how exactly it works. You go to talesfrombeyondthepale.com, and episodes are available each week. Is that what's happening?
Every Tuesday of the week for the next 10 weeks, and that'll be the first season all the way up to Christmas, and then it'll be available in December as a little CD. So you can also just buy it that way, and that'll be up on Amazon and all the usual things. And the special treat with the CD But indeed, every week on the website is the illustrations. Each one is lovingly illustrated by Gary Pullen, who's the designer of Rumor Magazine. It's just absolutely spectacular. In fact, we don't even need the audio portion of this treat. Just the posters are good enough.
And you have a great trailer made for the series as well, of Voltaire, the artist.
Yes,
Voltaire put together something.
The great Voltaire. I just invited him to kind of in lieu of doing an audio episode. He's provided this fabulous trailer, and that's also online. And please visit, enjoy that. It sets also our theme music up by Jeff Grace, our regular composer at Glass Eye, and just treats for all the senses.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure watching it all come together to get, you know, Voltaire's cut of his stop motion video, and then you know, to see what Jeff Grace was, or to hear Jeff Grace's score on top of that, and on top of that we have our sound designer Graham Resnick, who'd put some work onto it as well. So, you know, it's been an incredible project so far. You know, and just actually going in and recording details with the director and all the directors and all the voice talents we have has been an awful lot of fun.
Well, yeah, and you guys have great talent, and we had on Graham just a couple of months back, and we were crazy for him as well. And something that marks your company. It seems to be, you guys seem to be terrific innovators who are thrilled to have an opportunity to experiment.
Yeah, well, I don't know quite what our problem, it's what we drink at night.
just at night, Larry?
Well,
I think it's in the breakfast, too.
It's just a certain love of genre and capturing a wide-eyed affection for sort of a child's view, but mixing that with, at least from my point of view, a genuine outrage about the way of the world. So
yeah,
there's a naivete mixed with a ferocious anger, and that drives us to try to make good, frightening work that tries to shake people's complacency and entertain them at the same time.
Yeah, I think you do that. So tell me, Joe, starting with you, what in the film front, what are you guys working on?
You guys, can I go and not chase my kid and just say goodbye?
Yes, please.
Halloween, and it's been so fun. I appreciate talking, but I have other duties.
Okay, we understand. Thank you so much for taking time.
So please tell them your story. Bye.
All right.
This is the last question. Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
I actually I have a film that we just finished that I did in conjunction with the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago. They have a film division, Steppenwolf Films, and it's called The Last Rites of Joe May, and stars a lot of the Steppenwolf cast members, Dennis Farina, Gary Cole, and it's not horror at all. It's a straight drama. It's a, mm-hmm. sort of a throwback to the sort of early 70s, mid-70s tough guy films like The Friends of Eddie Coyle, you know, The Killing of the Chinese Bookie.
Oh, all the great films, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just that, Dennis Farina is an aging, short money con artist, a hustler, at the end of his life, and dealing with, you know, essentially a life of failure, but he's got this sort of, this undying optimism that there's some greatness, you know, waiting for him. And so it's just a straight up old school drama I'm very, very proud of. And so we're just finishing that and hoping, you know, in 2011 that'll be coming out. And I'm just writing some, you know, I wrote the radio play and got a few scripts in the works. And so we'll see what happens.
Terrific. Glenn, how about you?
I'm right now. I've written a script with a colleague called "The Damned and the Dangerous," and that's set in the 1930s in America. And it's definitely a genre film. Deals with vampires, but kind of going back to roots with vampires and vampire mythology from all over the world. like you know, the vampire traditions of Asia as well as Europe and South America. So tapping into all of that and kind of wrapping it all up in a sort of a most dangerous game type scenario.
Oh, cool.
And I'm currently the script is written, but I'm collaborating with Bram Ravel again, who's the comic book artist who turned my first feature, I Sell the Dead, into a comic. So currently working on that and basically just, continuing to develop that project and also working on a couple of other projects, working on a definitely a sort of a lower budget, more of an improv type project at the moment as well. So, you know, keeping busy and definitely keeping very busy with the radio show right now.
Absolutely, and I wish you guys the best of luck with all these projects.
Yeah.
And we're going to keep pushing Tales from Beyond the Pale. TalesfromBeyondThePale.com, where you can download the first episode from Joe, the man on the ledge. I wish you guys the best of luck. Thanks so much for coming in to tell us about it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And just to let you know that next Tuesday we'll be launching Simon Rumley's British and Proud.
Okay.
Awesome.
Great.
All righty. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Happy Halloween, guys.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Larry Fessenden and Glenn McQuaid and Joe Maggio from Glass Eye Picks, the people behind Tales from Beyond the Pale, the new radio play series that you can download now online. Interesting concept.
Oh, it's great. I mean, that's a really, you know, we should be appreciative because we're basically a radio show, so we can definitely relate to that. I think it's a great idea, though. And Larry, if I'm not mistaken, he directed The Last Winter and Wendigo, right? Great films. Really great small indie films that pack a very powerful punch. So,
and obviously The House of the Devil is a great
one. Oh,
The House of the Devil
is awesome.
And Stakeland, I've heard a lot of great things about.
Yeah.
I mean, we heard about that from Danielle Harris, too.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And it's the return of Kelly McGillis.
Always a good thing. Always a good thing, you know.
Yes.
Witness, Top Gun, yeah, we could go on and on.
Yeah. I wonder if she'll be in Tony Scott's Top Gun 2.
What's the deal with that exactly? Does anyone know what's up with that, or is that just a rumor, or is that fact?
More Top Gun. I don't know.
Okay.
but I will tell you that Tony Scott's new movie, Unstoppable, is fantastic. It is great.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It's a very efficient, fast-paced, 98-minute movie. It's really an intense movie. And, I mean, I like, for the most part, I like all of his movies, but I was very impressed by this one. And it almost has no second act. It moves so fast.
Okay, that's cool.
It moves so fast, it's like there's a problem with the train. They try to fix the problem.
That's cool. No, it looks good. It looks like a good one, so yeah.
That's the movie, so it's a good one. Okay, before we bring on Aaron to talk about home entertainment, let's play one of our film scores for the night.
Okay.
We're going to close with Harry Potter. We got to save that for
So you're going to save that. Okay, all right.
We
got to
make the Potter
fans. I see
Potter
how
fans.
It is.
Potter
I see
fans,
how it
wait.
Is. Okay. I see how you roll.
Here is, I'm all about satisfaction, drawing out the satisfaction as long as possible.
Dude, you're the greatest, you're probably the best host in this era, so.
I'm a tantric host.
No, you're the best host. The tantric, yes, but you're the best. You know how the game works. You know how to. As I said before, if you weren't the host on the show, we wouldn't be on right now. Okay?
Oh no! I mean, no. I read that interview that you did.
Yeah, I believe that though. I really believe that though. You understand? To me, you took all the great lessons that Larry King gave, even though I don't know if he was aware he was giving them, and you made them work for the show. So
I appreciate that.
No, but it's
true.
Really
do.
I mean, it really is. You understand there's a P.T. Barnum quality in you that you understand what people want. I don't understand that. You do, though, and I think that's more power to you.
So tell real quick, you did an interview with Canyon News.
Canyon News, a gentleman that we know through a mutual friend of the show, Jackie Jones,
And he wanted to interview me, so I just, it's a short interview, but I it's very important to, you know, when people talk about the show, it really has to be said that it's when the three of us, even though Chris isn't with us tonight, it's the three of us, Chris, me, and you, and it works so well. But, I mean, really, if you weren't, I mean, you understand show business. There's something about you that you understand what people want, and I do believe that's why the show has been on as long as it's been on, and why it will be on for a very long time to come.
Well, thank you, man. I mean, you're my right-hand man, though.
I'm trying to be, if I understood what a right hand was. Besides the obvious implications of what a right hand does, I know that I understand. Okay,
well, that's what you are to me.
Yeah, okay, well, thank you. But it is
so
important
it's
to
great
know.
For the show, though. It's great for the show that to get out there and do these interviews. So
thank you. It was great. My brother's email. Well, everyone who's in the business lives in those canyons, so you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I want to almost say thank you for stating the obvious.
Beverly Hills and it's great.
It was cool. You know, hopefully, though. What I'm hoping for is for the show, because we have come a long way with the show, but there's still so much to do with Movie Geeks United. I am hoping that one day we can get the three of us, like we did with Alan Levy's show a couple of years ago, to be interviewed together.
And it's just a matter of time before Movie Geeks United becomes a breath mint. I think we're going to.
I agree with you.
Start a product line. We're going to have a breath mint.
Well, I think we need to start T-shirts and posters and that sort of stuff.
All right, we'll start there.
Yeah. And breath mint.
Movie Geeks United in your mouth. That'll be the day with the breath mint. Okay. By the way, the Kubrick show is going well, guys. It's going to be so jam-packed, but it's going to be very special. And I guess I didn't tell you. Maybe I'll tell you now.
Okay, tell me now.
In the middle of in front of everybody else. And what I'm thinking is that we're going to go through mid-November because we have guests up until that point. Like we got Kerry Washington and Anthony Mackie and the Making of Empire Strikes Back guy and Ryan Quanten from True Blood. That airs this Wednesday. So we got some guests to get taken care of. And then we're probably going to take a couple of weeks off from it so we can work on editing and putting together this series. That'll start December 5th and run through December 12th.
That's awesome. Okay.
I mean, this is like a Kubrick. This is an epic Kubrick series.
I got Paths of Glory Blu-ray Criterion, so.
How's it look?
I haven't watched. We just got it, so I haven't watched it yet. But I did. I made sure. I mean, because I don't have it on DVD, so I wanted to make sure I got it on the Blu-ray. So,
well, pretty soon we're going to have a conversation about Kubrick, and we're going to bring on Chris, and so it's going to be all of us on the line together, roundtabling about Kubrick, and then we're going to include that in the show, obviously.
Okay, cool.
So I'll let you know whenever we can do that.
All right.
By the way. Speaking of Chris, did you see his Halloween costume?
No, I haven't. Oh, my God.
Go to his Facebook page.
I'm going
to
go right now. Okay.
Incredible. He does the greatest costumes. He's really into this stuff. And it's amazing. Look at those photos.
Oh, my God.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
Holy smokes.
I know. He needs to join a contest or something. He needs to go to a party where he can actually win something.
That's the best costume this year, hands down.
Yeah, I think so too. And he won his Harvey Two-Face a few years back.
Yeah, that's right. Oh my God,
That was great too. All right, here's John Powell's main theme score to the new film Fair Game, the new Doug Liman film starring Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. Here it is, and we'll come back on the other side with some home entertainment. Okay, that's John Powell's score to Fair Game. It's available now for purchase. If you go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net, you'll find the link where you can purchase it. And a little bit later, Welcome to the Rileys. We'll premiere that score, and we'll close the show with the new Harry Potter theme. Harry Potter!
I'm looking forward to the Harry Potter theme. I really am. Oh. I didn't realize it was conducted by Desplat, though. I had no idea. I thought it was, you know...
It's the opening selection that we have from the soundtrack that we'll play. So, I mean, he's great. And the movies are going to be great, I'm sure, and make a mint.
I mean, I definitely think it's interesting. You know, this one, they couldn't do 3D, but I think they're going to do 3D for the second part. But they couldn't. I wouldn't mind if they didn't do the second part in 3D. It's just, I don't know. None of the others have been in 3D. And
for Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises, yes, the title.
Mission Impossible has a title. Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol? Really? That's the... Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. Okay.
It's not going to be MI4. It's going to be Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol.
Oh, good for them for coming up with a semi-original title.
Makes it sound like an Xbox game, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. That's a good point.
All right. Let's bring out Aaron. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Hey, welcome, Aaron. How you doing? Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Looking forward to it. So, is that Mission... semicolon, impossible, comma, Ghost Protocol? How are they doing that?
Oh, I don't... That's another thing. Are there going to be two colons in the title?
Or is that going to be... I think they should go with the dash.
We're talking about Tom Cruise here. I mean, I'm sure he'll take as many colons as possible.
I mean, I would go with a dash. I think the dash would be the way to go. And Jamie, just to add to the compliments that Gary was giving, you are the black Arsenio Hall of radio.
I don't know what to say to that.
I'll take it.
Okay,
you had a follow-up.
Yeah.
All right, Home Entertainment. We got a lot of DVD releases. Let me pull up my website so I can recall all the DVD releases that we are covering on tonight's show.
There are a ton of them. We're entering the fourth quarter, as you know, as they say in business terminology, and so the studios are really bringing out the big guns, if you will, and fourth quarter is always the holiday season, so they always bring out the best of the best, and it's always fun. Even though everyone's talking about how last few years DVD sales have plateaued and maybe even declined, and that is true. And Blu-ray is every holiday season, Blu-ray seems to be rising, peaking, up and up. And I think studios are, while they're not flooding the market like they were about 5-6 years ago, I think they are, putting an effort once again on the titles they are bringing out. And a couple of studios that were kind of hesitant, particularly Paramount and Universal, they're finally, I think, not only getting into the Blu-ray game, but also, putting some care into their releases. So,
mm-hmm. Now, you've covered a couple of the releases on your show Back by Midnight here at Blog Talk Radio in the past couple of weeks, including Paths of Glory. I mean, Jerry mentioned that. You've done a show on that airs actually this Tuesday, doesn't it?
Yes, it airs this Tuesday. I got to talk to Curtis Cho, the producer of the disc, and he saw it from transfer to final product, and I asked him, I go, how did this title come into the Criterion collection? Because you figure Kubrick, obviously Warner Brothers, which has the majority of the Kubrick films, they're not licensing them out. But Path of Glory is pre Warner Brothers Kubrick, and he's saying that the DVD sales have kind of plateaued, studios are now a little more open to licensing older titles in their catalog to, kind of boutique labels. That was the thing, back in 2004 to 2005 period, when studios, they were making money on, Buckaroo Banzai and Hudson Hawk special editions. There was no need to license. They could do it, but once it started to plateau, they realized, not everything we flood into the market is gonna bring back a substantial amount. So I think they put a moratorium on some of their back catalog. titles, and now they're like, well, we can license some of these. You know, they're kind of niche to boutiques. So I think that's, you know, that Path of Glory is a key example, which was a Laserdisc of Criterion back in the day. So, but
right. What's on the Blu-ray? What special features?
Well, there's some interviews that are really, really fascinating that Curtis conducted both with the producers, John Harlan and James B. Harris, who also co-wrote the script with Kubrick, and Christian Kubrick does an interview. And so he conducted these interviews himself. There's an audio interview. It's a brief audio interview with Kubrick, but they found that in the archives. And one of the most interesting things that we talked in my interview with him was he talked about, you know, going to the Kubrick archives library, and he goes, it's open to the public. He goes, you know, it's not a private library. It's open to the public. All you have to do is call ahead and say, I'm going to be there on this day, and this is the stuff I want to look at, and they will they'll pull it out for you, basically. And, you know, each film basically has, you know, it's segregated by film, so each film has its own, you know, section, if you will. And Path of Glory was kind of interesting in that it was, I guess you could say, it wasn't as extensive. You know, I think Kubrick really started to get into keeping, you know, everything about his films, I guess, really with maybe, Strangelove or 2001, particularly 2001, but I'm thinking also Strangelove. But, you know, these earlier films, he still managed to keep quite a bit of stuff, be it a lot of memos and some screenplays and all kinds of other things. And he goes, it's just fascinating. You're seeing this memo, you know, that Stanley Kubrick handwriting with a coffee stain. He goes, so it's kind of interesting. You know, it's kind of like, for cinephiles, it's like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
That's a good analogy. That's a great analogy, Aaron.
I'm flying up there for research for their series.
Oh, yeah. Well, I asked him, I go,
I'm kidding,
by
the way.
I know you're kidding, but it was the way you said that was so perfect.
I asked him.
Because I want to know what kind of coffee he drinks. I want to know where that stain came from.
You know, it's decaf. I asked him about reviews, you know, because I knew, I had heard Kubrick kept every review. In Path of Glory, he did have a few reviews, particularly the New York Times, which he said amusingly was a positive review, but also a harsh review. But, you know, in the other films, like, you know, Full Metal Jacket and The Shining, I mean, I've read this, you know, Kubrick, he kept every review that he could find that was ever written, you know, and which is kind of, you know, I find that kind of amusing that there is actually a review from the Akron Times of, you know, Ohio, that, you know, of The Shining that Kubrick, you know, archived along with Time and Newsweek.
He didn't miss a beat. I mean, he would measure the ads in the newspapers to make sure that they were what they were getting what they were paying for. And if it were like, you know, just a bit of an inch off, he'd call. He'd make a call and say, why am I in London? Why am I in England? And I know about this screw up, but you don't. And you're there in the center of L.A. You know, he was a taskmaster, no doubt. Okay, Alien, just to move on.
Oh,
that's
yes.
Another show that you recently did about that new anthology.
Yes, the Alien Anthology, which is basically in 2003, kind of one of the gold standards was set in movie box sets for DVD, which was the Alien Quadrilogy, which was this 9-disc.
I have
box.
That. Yeah.
Gary had that. You know, it was the 4 films on 4 discs, and then each film got its own supplemental disc, and then a catch-all disc, disc 9. And so, I mean, it was one of those, you know, it was a fourth quarter release of 2003, and
that's
everyone
right.
had it. And so now, you know, 7 years later, it's been they've new transfers for new transfers for Alien and Alien, new 4K high def transfers for those two, and you know, they've transferred it to Blu-ray. So the Quadrilogy has been ported over to Blu-ray, plus hours of new stuff that was not even in the Quadrilogy. You know. In my show, as we talked about, as I was talking to Bill Hunt of the Digital Bits, we were analyzing this. He goes, you know, he remembers, you know, when they first proposed Blu-ray disc, and they said this 50 GB disc, you know, well, and everyone's like, well, who's going to need 50 GB of memory? That's just ridiculous. And, you know, here we are in the Alien Blu-ray, and he goes, you know, there was stuff that they had to take off, you know, so, you know, you give them all the space you want, they're going to want more space. And so this Alien. Now the Alien Anthology, that's called on Blu-ray, which came out this Tuesday, is pretty, once again, it's probably going to be a benchmark in, at the very least, as when it comes to big studio Blu-ray packaging. It's pretty remarkable. In fact, this day, this past Tuesday, October 26th, was kind of a two-prong seismic event for Blu-ray, and I'm kind of interested to see how the sales go, because not only was the Alien series put out on Blu-ray in this kind of mammoth, definitive set, but also the Back of the Future trilogy.
That's right.
Yeah.
They both came out this week. So since this Back of the Future trilogy Blu-ray anniversary edition is kind of the definitive one also. So it'll be interesting to see how.
But Universal doesn't work with either one of us, do they?
No, no.
Okay, so we don't have to talk about Back to the Future.
We don't have to talk about but I will say this. This is a good example, as we were talking about, as I was saying at the top of the segment, is that, you know, some studios that weren't even putting care into their DVD/Blu-ray, this is an example of a studio finally taking risks and, you know, seeing that there is potential if they just put, you know, the proper energy into it. So maybe the title turn.
Maybe. Okay, but I'm curious about one thing with the Alien Anthology, and that's what I'm sure a lot of fans out there are curious about, is Alien 3, David Fincher's film. There's a documentary, an uncut documentary, available for the first time?
Yes. If people remember on the Quadrilogy, the making of documentary was called, was actually just called The Making of Alien, Alien 3. It was very bland. And what had happened was the producer of the series, Charles
Charles.
This was basically Alien 3 was the reason he wanted to do this whole thing. He wanted to reconstruct the Alien 3, the work print of it, David Fincher, and what he was trying to get at, and tell that story, which is one of the last 20, 30 years of one of the great, you know, fabled, troubled production stories ever.
Oh, yeah.
He turned into documentary, and at the last minute, Fox got kind of cold feet on some of the more, you know, unpleasantness that went on, and they were kind of fearful of maybe reprisals or repercussions from this documentary, and they said, you know, they censored it. They took out 21 minutes, and Charles took his name off of it, and so forth. And so a few people had seen it, and they said it was great stuff, but it had gotten, you know, redacted, if you will, at the last minute.
He's right. You're right. There's a great article I was reading this about an interview with Vincent Ward. I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday on IMDb. It was on their hit list.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was the original director of Alien 3, and it was all his plans, what he had envisioned for the third film. And it's a fascinating read, and you'll forgive me, I don't remember what the website was that had it.
We actually had a listener email us last week asking us if we could interview him.
It'd be a great interview.
I love Map of the Human Heart and the Navigator. Those are great.
I even love What Dreams May Come. It's a great
film. No, that's a very good film. Thank you, Aaron, for bringing it. That's right. That's the other thing he did. And it's a fascinating interview, though, because it's a recent interview, and he hasn't lost any of his enthusiasm for the third Alien film, what he wanted to do.
Right. It's
really interesting.
So the controversy surrounding this documentary, I would imagine, is the fact that it shows how compromised the film was.
Yeah.
Yes, it shows the second guessing that went on. You know, they brought on Fincher because, you know, he was a hot video and commercial guy, you know, so now he wanted to do a film. Kind of like Ridley, you know, Ridley Scott, when he did Alien, he'd only done really one film, The Duelist. He'd done
Right.
But he was a commercial guy. So here's kind of the repeat that, you know, commercial music video guy, and give us his first film and bring something back like the Ridley style. But then Fincher's like, okay, you hired me, let me do what I want to do. But, you know, it was a lot of second guessing, and it was also a case where they put the release date before production, so they were trying to make a release date as opposed to make a film. And so there's a lot of frustration with the producer, the line producer on the thing, and getting the effects and all this kind of stuff. And other kind of turmoil. They had to change DPs because the first DP grew ill, and so all this stuff. And so the uncut documentary is now called Wreckage and Rage, The Making of Alien 3, which is the official title. And now that 21 minutes that was taken out is now put in, and you really get this vision of this film that was, you know, now it, because it Fincher is Fincher, people have gone back and, you know, it has some very rabid fans who say, you know, if he had been left alone, this film could have been a masterpiece and so forth, which is all second sight. I like Alien 3 as compromised
mm-hmm.
it is, but the fact is, and this is a slight tangent here, the fact is that there was an Alien 3 kind of doomed it to begin with, because Aliens, the Cameron film, ends the story how the audience wants it. Alien has been destroyed. The planet's been destroyed. Ripley and her makeshift family are heading back to Earth with her surrogate daughter, and everything is right with the world. Peace has been restored to the universe. And that's the ending of Aliens, and that's the ending everyone was happy with.
Right.
So the fact that you even greenlight Alien 3 is a bummer, because you're basically saying none of that, it negates everything, the happy ending.
Yeah.
So even if Fincher had been left alone in when Alien 3 came out in May of 92, it still would have been kind of a disappointment. Fans didn't want that. Fans were not ready in 1992 for that bleakness.
You know who wanted it, though? You know who wanted it? Reading that Cameron biography, you know, Cameron had written Aliens and hadn't even consulted Sigourney Weaver. So the studio said, we love the script, so let's get Sigourney on board. And he said, all right, we got to get Sigourney. So he met with her, and she loved the conception of the character, the tough kind of renegade fighter. But she really wanted Ripley to fall in love with the alien, to become impregnated by the alien.
Mm-hmm.
She had all these ideas that ended up showing up, Alien 3. And
especially 4 that shows up. You're right about that.
So, I mean,
okay.
So it's just a fascinating film. And, you know, Fincher gave his blessing to the reconstruction of the work print and to the documentary. He has no ill feelings to the people who put the specialist together, but he had moved on, and it's just a chapter of his life that he doesn't really want to dwell on. I mean, it was funny when Panic Room came out on DVD. If you went to his filmography on the DVD, he omits Alien 3 for David Fincher. 7 is his debut film.
Really? Okay. Wow. I didn't know.
So
that.
That's just the way it is. And so, I mean. So that's all. So Alien 3 is always going to be one of those films. It's that's just going to be a constant. What if this had happened? What if that had happened? And,
right.
Okay. Here's let's talk. Well, we've already talked about the movie, The Human Centipede, but it's available now on DVD. And as soon as my computer catches up, hang on, I'm going to play this trailer for The Human Centipede, and then I'm going to announce the two winners that we have for the DVD.
Yes, I was wondering if I could get driving directions to a nightclub called...
Hello, sweetie.
No, we're in Germany right now. Maybe we can talk to you later?
All right, we miss you.
Bye, Amy.
Bye, sweetie.
I think we're supposed to turn. I thought you knew exactly where we were going. What was that? We came from over here, I swear. We just got a little lost.
A little lost?
Yes, we are not a little lost. We are really lost.
Hello, can anyone help?
We got a flat tire. Can we come in?
Something strange.
And tourists.
We are on a road trip through Europe.
Like yes.
Can you call the emergency car service for us? You have a really lovely home.
The Siamese triplet connected via the gastric system. The human centipede, first sequel. We start with cutting the ligaments of the kneecap.
Ah! Oh, yes!
So climb, Jenny.
Hurry up! Come to here!
Open the door!
Did you see that yet, Jared?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I'm not sure I want to after that, but
yeah,
no, I do want to check it out because I am curious. I am curious about it.
It is the gift that keeps on giving, and that's why we're pleased to announce that our listeners Ron Oliver and Michael Addis will be sent a copy of The Human Centipede on DVD. So thank you both for participating in the contest, and thank you all for your entries. We got some interesting stories about the most traumatic kind of horror film experience people have had and why. And I guess I should read one of these.
Yeah, you should, man. Definitely.
Yeah. Let me bring up the screen, and then I will.
Do we know if anyone is going as the Human Centipede for Halloween?
I thought that would be great. That would be a great idea.
Well, I'm looking at the kids leaving our house right now, and no Human Centipedes right now.
Yeah, clearly that's an adult kind of costume.
And Halloween party, probably.
Yeah, I think porn stars would, Sasha Grey might agree to do the Human Centipede.
Great, there goes Sasha Grey forever being on our show.
Sasha Grey and Jennifer Connelly.
Oh, God, Jennifer. There goes Jennifer Connelly from being on the show, too. We've just...
Yeah. You know, and he's making the second one now, and they asked him in this DVD if you were to recast for an American remake, and he just named, like, Tom Cruise, Julia Roberts.
Oh, wow. He's really... Oh, my God.
Naming all the big ones, you know?
I can see that.
Yeah. But he'd probably end up with some, you know, David Hasselhoff, somebody like that.
Betty White.
To bring up this entry, but
Betty White in the new Human
Betty White in the Human Centipede. That would be great. Okay.
That's the long lost Golden Girls episode that we never saw.
I promise I'll bring this up. Anyway. I should have brought it up earlier, but it's an interesting story. If it comes up, I'll read it on air. Another movie I want to talk about, and then we'll get to another one of yours, Aaron, is Roger Corman. Cult classics are now available through the Shout Factory.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Shout Factory also released The Psycho Legacy, which we covered last week during our horror series as part of our Psycho show. And just great titles, all the famous titles from Corman's library are now available on DVD, including like Ivan Reitman's directorial debut for him called Cannibal Girls.
Cannibal Girls.
Here's a trailer for it, and then I'll bring up that story.
In the 70s and 80s, where movies pushed the envelope and tested your limits, one man gave us some of the most wild and outrageous films ever. Producer and director Roger Corman.
It's time for action.
And now, Shout Factory is bringing his over-the-top vision back on DVD. Roger Corman, cult classic. Over 50 films. Some never before released on DVD. With all new bonus features and film transfers.
The hottest band this side of the Iron Curtain, The Ramones!
Featuring your favorite Hollywood talent. And brand new Ultimate Collector Editions of Corman's most popular movie, Rock and Roll High School.
Kitty is rocking!
2000.
I don't want you to die.
And Piranha.
Piranhas?
What a bunch of piranhas!
They're eating the guests.
So grab some friends.
Body burn!
Make some popcorn and experience all the loud rock and roll. Scandalous women. Extreme violence. Gory monsters. And hardcore action you can handle. Roger Corman Cult Classic, now on DVD.
The moment of truth is at hand.
Okay, Roger Corman's Cult Classics are now available on DVD. If you go to, and they're being released sporadically too, throughout the remainder of the year. If you go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net/media, you can purchase those and all the other DVDs that we're talking about here. Here's the winning entry for The Human Centipede. Hey guys, I'm a TV film director. I did Poor White Trash and Heckler. I was working with Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn once. That's his name, and heard they went to see Audition in the theaters and walked out because they were so freaked out by it. I thought they were wimps and decided to not only see it myself but take a date. Always a good move, taking a date to Audition. I went out and spent the last 30 minutes covering my face and yelling, no, I was completely losing my mind, but I wouldn't walk out. My date, meanwhile, a cool girl from Chicago, was unfazed by it and just watched while eating her Whoppers and popcorn. I couldn't believe what a scary movie that was. A couple years later, I ran into Eli Roth, who ended up being in my movie Heckler, and told him that Hostel reminded me of the vibe of Audition, which made him the happiest man in the world. He obviously digs the movie, too. I'm really proud that I didn't soil myself watching Audition. But I still get goosebumps when somebody says kitty kitty.
Meet a girl who's eating popcorn and Whoppers during a movie.
Yeah. All right. I got to play this clip so we can get it taken care of in this. What other titles do you have, Aaron?
What other titles do I have here? Well, what is it? It's the 26th. Well, and so, yes. Well, this is kind of a preview title. And,
okay.
Jamie, we talked about this earlier. But coming out on DVD, but more importantly, Blu-ray, Lars von Trier's Antichrist. It's Halloween.
Oh, wow.
I might as well bring
yeah.
it up. Lars von
That's
Trier's
a Criterion,
Antichrist.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That
yeah.
is also Criterion. And I told you when I got this in the mail, you said, well, you enjoy that. And I asked you, will I enjoy Lars von Trier's Antichrist? And you never gave me a response. So I'm assuming...
Well, he's honest, you know.
If you do enjoy it, I have to question hanging around.
Enjoy might not be the right word.
Yeah.
Gary, have you seen this?
Yeah, I've seen it. I watched it on Netflix, actually, when they had it.
Right.
And I watched it. Enjoy may not be the right word, but it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, enjoy. I don't know if you enjoy Antichrist, and even I have to say there may, you know, does your health plan have psychiatry covered? You know, so.
Well, speaking of, and well, so to go from one extreme to the other release that came out this past Tuesday, this is a TV release, and I'm a little disappointed that they did not hype this more because I think it's a spectacular release. And that is The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson.
A 15-disc
set of uncut episodes over from the 30 years of The Carson Show. And it, for any true TV file, TV talk show, late night historian or late night buff or just Carson fan, this is the set to get. And what's interesting about it, and this set is interesting to look at in perspective on two things. One, obviously, in about a week, we're going to get Conan on TBS.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Tuesday, this coming up Tuesday in a couple of days, Bill Carter's book about the second late night talk show wars is being published. As some of y'all know, it got excerpts were published on VanityFair.com, and it's quite revealing. So seeing this kind of history of the Tonight Show in context of all this new kind of brouhaha that's happened is really, really fascinating. So one hand you have Lars von Trier's Antichrist, kind of the art house answer to torture porn, and the Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson box set. So,
great.
So yeah, so those are pretty two amazing titles. James, are you going to bring up everyone's favorite pirate treasure movie from 1985? Are you going
to? I'm about to.
Okay.
But let's play Welcome to the Riley Score real quick so I can get my stuff together.
Okay.
to do this. Here's the score to the new Jay Kasdan movie, Welcome to the Rileys.
Comedy, Welcome to the Rileys. That's rather a spooky score.
Well, I think it's more along the lines of a drama.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
I mean, I hear Gandolfini's great in it, and Kristen Stewart is great in it. I mean, he befriends a lonely stripper, and she comes in and tries to save his marriage with Melissa Leo. It's one of those I'm looking forward to seeing.
Yeah,
I am too. That's ideal stripper music.
Is the Prince ain't got nothing on that. All right, Criterion has a couple of releases out that I want to talk about just briefly, just mention that they're available, and you can purchase them on our website. The Magician, which is an Ingmar Bergman film. Bergman's very well represented on Criterion, and this is no exception. And a real oddity, a Japanese film called House. It's from 1977. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the names involved in it, but it was made to kind of be a cult classic, I think. And it is an absolute oddity. And that's the thing about Criterion. They'll come out with the prestigious stuff, and it's the off-kilter titles, too, that are very interesting
One of the best extras on there, or most interesting one, is talking about earlier, is an appreciation of House by Ty West.
Who was
a big fan of House. And obviously that film had, if not a direct influence, did have a kind of a maybe aesthetic or just, an inspirational influence on him when he decided to become a filmmaker.
I could see it in something like House of the Devil. I mean, it's there in the title, too, House.
I'm waiting for Criterion.
We're not talking about the TV show. But
I'm waiting for Criterion to do the... four-disc set of all the House movies.
Yeah. The William Cat thing, yeah. I think Anchor Bay would tackle that before Criterion. But to give you a sense of how weird this movie is, how strange, here's 45 seconds of it.
Oh, my God.
Here you go.
House.
Thank you.
that they said that was screaming.
I see in your eyes where tomorrow and silence.
There you go. That sounded a little like Schwarzenegger, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah. House is now available from Criterion. So check it out on our website or their website, CriterionCO.com. Also, The Goonies 25th Anniversary Box Set. It's got a lot of goodies. Here's what's included in it.
It's been 25 years since The Goonies hit, and ever since they've had a cult following. On November 2nd, Warner Home Video is releasing a collector's edition DVD to commemorate the anniversary. And the special release is no slouch in terms of value. It comes with a making-of documentary, a video for Cyndi Lauper's song The Goonies Are Good Enough, deleted scenes, and the original theatrical trailer. And if that's not enough, you also get a new board game, storyboard prints, a souvenir magazine from 1985, and more.
Okay, so that film will be released November 2nd, Tuesday, on DVD, is that enormous box set that she just described. So who is the winner from our entries into this contest to win the Goonies DVD box set? Christina Sly and Laura Mel Tan. I just chose your entries. you'll receive the box set from Movie Geeks United. As long as you're lifelong loyal listeners, you'll receive it.
I gotta ask Gary, tell me just briefly, 25 words or less, your memory of seeing Goonies in the theaters.
I saw The Goonies of Steve Richards when it came out. I liked it, but the trailer for Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome really captured my attention more than anything else.
Exactly. And let me ask you this, Gary, because I've been having some conversations about summer mentality in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time when Goonies was coming out, did you, you know, obviously it was the year after Temple of Doom.
Right.
So did you feel like, well, this is not an Indiana Jones, but they're giving me kind of a retread of Indiana Jones, or did you take it as what it was?
I took it for what it was. You know, I didn't really think of it as a retread. Why would they think of it as a retread of Indiana Jones? Because of Short Round, or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the Short Round, kind of the whole cliffhanger after another kind of deal, the searching for this treasure, which is, you know, basically, you know, all the Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I see that. No, we didn't even think about that at the time. It was just, there was a couple factors involved, but it was, you remember, it's one of, you know, the film that film gets lobbed in with Explorers and Weird Science and Real Genius that year. They're all the teenage and science and experimentation films that year. So, and my science project, Bill Doom, to be honest with you.
You know where that did come into play for me? And obviously it's a great movie. It stands on its own. But it was Romancing the Stone.
Yeah,
I remember
that's right.
Watching Temple of Doom, and I was like, They can't make an action movie that good. What can top it? And so I watched Romancing the Stone, and automatically it diminished on my mind because it just couldn't compare. But that was in a 13, 14-year-old kid's mind. But,
right, yeah.
And obviously it stands, like, upon reflection, The Goonies is just, it's an enormously popular
book.
Which was the answer to our trivia question, which is how they won the DVD tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the fact, I mean, and Brolin has said this, you know, he's basically said this in recent interviews, you know, since this kind of, you know, the second career that he's gotten with W and, you know, you've got True Grit and Wall Street and all these other films, Milk and so forth, you know, he's pretty much, you know, because of that, he's now okay with talking about Goonies, because I guess now, you know, obviously now he doesn't have to worry about, you know, when he passes away, you know, the obituary. Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
Brand from Goonies, you know, that's not going to be the lead line.
Yeah, yeah. And Jerry, you mentioned Beyond Thunderdome. When you watch The Goonies, the first Mad Max is now available on Blu-ray for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That's another release, and which reminds me that the next Mad Max was delayed again. They're supposed to start shooting.
No.
It was delayed by rain.
I'm not sure. I don't understand it, but it's one of those situations where it put the whole entire film community, local film community, in jeopardy because they had everyone had they hey, we'll be employed for this amount of time, but now they're up in the air, so there's a lot of worry down there. But of course, Tom Hardy is in the next Batman film, so he's okay. But I don't know what that says about the Australian film community as a whole, or the production. And this happened before with The Fountain, when Brad Pitt pulled out of The Fountain in 2002. But this was a big stink. You know, everyone reserves their time in that community to be in to work on that film. So I don't know what happens with Mad Max now. I don't.
It's the same thing with their nervousness over the Hobbit in New Zealand.
In New Zealand,
They're going to shoot there, but, you know, what a boon to their economy. I mean, you depend on that kind of thing.
Yeah, you do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But Mad Max is available on a special edition 2-disc Blu-ray DVD combo. And Shout Factory, that came out with Psycho Legacy and all the Corman stuff, they also have come out with Mystery Science Theater 3000 Season 19.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big collector's box. It's got a lot of goodness in it, if you like Mystery Science Theater, and it's available for purchase on our website. As is a lot of other titles from Anchor Bay, you'll see them there, The Killing Machine, Circle. There's another one starring Steve Austin that is available now.
Mm-hmm.
So just go to the website, and you'll find it all there, moviegeeksunited.net/media. Anything else, Aaron? Is there anything else on your mind in these closing moments of the show?
A lot of goodness going out into the world, and sure, all this home video. I'm excited. Rock Band came out with the keyboard, so that's
that's cool. I do have a question. Actually, I do have a serious question about the latest Wes Anderson on Criterion Blu-ray. Is that worthwhile getting? Because I never purchased the original, but is that worthwhile to pick up? Because I
film
a lot.
If you're a Wes Anderson fan, you gotta do the complete collection.
Okay.
And this is Criterion. God bless them. They Wes Anderson is one of their directors, so they've done all of his films. So they went full steam ahead on Darjeeling Limited, and I'm excited. I'm just waiting, and it'll happen soon enough when they go back and bring out Rushmore and Tenenbaums on Blu-ray.
Right. Okay.
So that's what I'm waiting for. But no, Darjeeling Limited, and I'm actually a huge Darjeeling Limited fan.
Oh,
I love
me too.
Not only the film,
I like it very much.
And I actually prefer to Life Aquatic, a film that I admire more than I guess you could say love. I admire Life Aquatic, but I do love Darjeeling Limited.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand what you mean. I do like the Darjeeling Limited as well. I just wasn't sure. But it sounds like from what you're saying, it is definitely worthwhile getting. And it is a film I love. There's a lot of great moments in that film.
Yeah. So, yeah, Darjeeling Limited, definitely worth it. Also, Criterion DVD and Blu-ray. Definitely worth picking up.
Okay.
So,
and tune into Aaron's show Tuesday, because that's when he'll be covering Paths of Glory on Tuesday's show. And then you have future shows on the BBS.
Yes, I have a big show coming up in a couple of weeks on Criterion, kind of Criterion's, big release of the fourth quarter, which is America, Lost and Found, the BBS story, which is this 7-disc box of all the films put out by BBS Productions, which stood for Bert, Bob, and Steve. Bert Snyder, Bob Rafelson, and Steve Blommer from the late 60s, early 70s. They did Head, which was a Monkees movie, Five Easy Pieces, Easy Rider, Safe Place, Last Picture Show, Drive, He Said, Jack Nicholson's directorial debut, and The King of Marvin Gardens. So on my show, I will be to talk about this particular, you know, brief but very vital part of New Hollywood history. I'm going to have author Peter Biskin going to come on.
Wrote
the book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and he's going to talk about this period. And I just talked to this past week to arrange an interview. I will have Karen Black, actress who was in Five Easy Pieces and, King of Marvin Gardens and a bunch of others. Also, she was also in a film which is just out on the Warner Archives, you know, make-on-demand system, Coppola's first film, You're a Big Boy Now, which is just now out on the Warner Archives. So if you are interested in Coppola, and if you do not know this film, it is his first film, You're a Big Boy Now, Rip Torn, Geraldine Page, Karen Black, a terrific, strange coming-of-age story with a terrific score by The Loving Spoonful.
Yeah, and Jamie, you had a great conversation with Peter Biskin about the Warren Beatty biography a couple last year, if I'm not mistaken.
We just talked about banging the whole time.
Yeah.
The whole half hour. But, yeah, he's a fountain of knowledge about that era in Hollywood
definitely.
History. So he's a great conversation. You're going to have fun with that. And you also have a 24 show that you're planning, right?
Yes, that will be in December, probably December 14th, which is the day that 24, the complete series box.
Good, you're not competing with Mike Kubrick. That's good.
That's very good. Thank God.
And so lined up already, I will be talking to Stephen Hopkins, the filmmaker who did the pilot for 24 and a bunch of other episodes, and also Sean Callery, who did the score for the entire series. One of the most iconic
scores score.
Of the last decade, because I mean, no one else could do the bleep bleeps like Sean Callery.
And there's also in that work in the compositions for 24. I mean, it really is film music.
Yes, it's
very cinematic and full.
Yes, it is. I'll be talking to them too, and more guests, hopefully, to be determined. And so that'll be my, every now and then I do these shows to highlight whenever a complete series box set comes out. I like to, do retrospective. I've done it on The Shield, Deadwood, Wire, Sopranos. So doing it here, so maybe next fall or next summer I'll do the Big Love complete series.
Yeah, because that's ending now. Yeah.
Oh, is it ending?
This is going to be the last season. I love that show. I just got the Nip Tuck complete series. Nip Tuck.
Damn, man, you get everything, man.
No, I don't get everything. Believe me.
I know, but
30, you get 35 discs in that thing.
35 discs? Really?
Shit.
Okay.
So you have 100 episodes. Are you going to do the Nip Tuck marathon, Jamie?
I just might. But we'll cover that on our next home entertainment show.
Okay.
And then Wednesday, I'll talk about Love and Other Drugs. And we have Ryan Kwanten, who plays Jason Stackhouse in the True Blood series. He has a new movie out, a really good movie, just a kick-ass movie called Red Hill.
It's an
Australian Western that's just great. So he'll be on Wednesday. And then Sunday we'll have J.W. Rensler, the writer of The Making of The Empire Strikes Back. The next Wednesday we'll have Anthony Mackie and Kerry Washington. And possibly some other guests are coming up too, so tune in for that. We got to play Harry Potter to go out.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do Harry Potter. Let's do it.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Gallows?
Hollows.
Deathly Hollows. I like gallows better. Wow, that's
Harry Potter and the Vincent Gallo? Wasn't that the title? Of the...
No, the Vincent Gallows.
Yes. That's some guy. That's one guy I'd like to interview.
That's a garage rock.
That'd be great. That's an hour interview.
Yeah, yeah.
If he doesn't hang up first.
Thank you, buddy, for coming on talking DVDs with us.
Love it, man. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Me too.
Thank you, Aaron.
I'll talk to you tonight.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Here's Alexandre Desplat's opening title score to Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows,
there you
part
go.
One.
Good night, everyone.
Talk to you Wednesday, man.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.